And members, today is January 21st, and I'd like to call the meeting of the State Government Finance and Elections Committee order pursuant to Rule 10.01. This will be a virtual meeting. If the legislative assistant can take the roll.
Chair Nelson?
I'm here.
Vice Chair Carlson?
Carlson, present.
Representative Nash?
Present.
Representative Bonner?
Present.
Representative Drazkowski? Representative Elkins?
Present.
Representative Greenman?
Present.
Representative Cleburne?
Present.
Representative Kosnick?
Kosnick, present.
Representative Mason?
Present.
Representative New Brindley?
Present.
Representative Pawlowski?
Present.
Representative Quam?
Present.
You have a quorum present. Chair Nelson, you're muted.
Mute myself, I just realized that. The minutes were sent out for the last meeting. Representative Cleburne, did you get a chance to look at the minutes?
Yes, thank you, Chair Nelson, and I move that the minutes from Tuesday, January 19th be adopted as written.
The motion has been made to approve the minutes for January 19th. All in favor, say aye.
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 Opposed? The minutes have been approved. Just to note, the House File 52 has been referred down to the Local Government Committee. So that's something we don't have to take any further action, just mentioned in the committee. We're going to start with the presentation this morning, and we've got the Legislative Commission on Pensions, and we got the State Board of Investment, and I got the two of them together today because they're kind of tied together. How good our returns we get from the State Board of Investment will determine how good our pensions are holding up, and whether we have the money there to be able to pay those pensions out that have been promised to our employees. So we're going to start with the State Board of Investments, and Mansco Perry is the executive director, and welcome to the committee. And if you want to identify yourself for the record, and then you can proceed with your presentation.
Morning, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Mansco Perry. I'm the executive director and chief investment officer for the State Board of Investment. I'll kind of give you an overview of the state board then kind of give you an update as to how things have gone since the beginning of the current fiscal year. Andy, you want to start the PowerPoint? Thank you. Okay, next slide. So State Board, we're the state's authority for managing monetary assets. And as of the end of the last fiscal year, we were responsible for $102 billion. These assets represent retirement plans, trust accounts like the Permanent School Fund or the Environmental Trust Fund. And we also are responsible for managing the state cash accounts, which comprise the assets of the general fund and the amounts appropriated to state agencies. The State Board of Investment retains quite a few investment managers to manage most of the public retirement assets. These include in excess of 40 stock and bond managers who are responsible for over 70 portfolios, and over 100 private market managers who are responsible for 250 plus funds in our overall retirement pension portfolio. Next, Andy. So the State Board of Investment is actually authorized by Article 11 of the Minnesota Constitution and consists of four of the five constitutional officers. The governor sits as chair, and the other three members are the state auditor, secretary of state, and the attorney general. The board is assisted by a 17-member investment advisory council. 10 of these members are from the public and are required to have some experience with or knowledge of investments and finance. The three executive directors of the three statewide retirement plans are ex officio members, along with the commissioner of management and budget. And the governor appoints two active members, two active employees for members of the plans, and one retiree member. Currently, there are 24 members of my staff, but we're beginning a process to grow that out to catch up with many of our other peers. Next, Andy. So our budget is comprised of two pieces. We receive an appropriation of the general fund of $139,000, but most of the funds that we get to operate our enterprise are from dedicated receipts. These are the dollars that we charge back to our various clients for the assets that we manage. And we have a statutory appropriation, which covers the cost of our investment consultants and a variety of investment and accounting resources that we need to.
Ansel, can you speak up a little bit? You're fading away. I don't know if you're talking to your microphone or not.
I'm usually accused of that, but I probably have. There, that should be better. Okay.
It's a little bit better, but you're still kind of quiet. And I know you're quiet. You speak quietly anyway. So anyway, go on.
Okay. You know, we get most of our receipts from dedicated receipts and statutory appropriation. Next slide, Andy. So our budget process, we our staff puts together a management and budget plan every year, where we spell out what will be needed to operate the staff and run the office. Our process is after I finalize my proposal, it's reviewed by the ESPA Administrative Committee, which is made up of the three executive directors of the statewide plans, a designee from each of the board members, and two members of the Investment Advisory Council. Once they approve and endorse it, it's taken to the board generally at our second quarter meeting to finalize the final work plan and the budget for the coming fiscal year. So over the last 5 years, I'll give you a snapshot of how well we've done in the various investment programs that we run. For the last 5 years, our investments have had an increase of almost $24 billion, with an increase in the pension assets of about $5 billion a year. We have distributed $13 billion over that time, an average of about $2.5 billion a year, which is the state's portion of benefit payments. We contribute about 72 cents from our investment portfolio to support benefits, about 72 cents out of every benefit payment dollar that's paid out. Over this time, we've also made in excess of $400 million for the non-retirement assets under our charge. As I said, that would be like the closed landfill fund, permanent school fund, environmental trust fund, and a variety of other smaller funds that are in our pool. And also during that time period, we've been able to earn about $850 million for the invested treasurer cash assets, adding about $175 million each year. Next. So as I said, my staff is, there are 24 of us, 15 who are on the investment staff, and we have nine employees on our accounting and administrative staff. The investment staff is compensated under a salary plan that the legislature adopted back in the early 2000s and was updated about 2 years ago. We're hoping to grow the staff. We've consistently have had a very small staff while productive. One of the concerns that I have is that we are significantly below our peers, and as time passes on, that just adds more risk to the viability of our enterprise. Next, please. So the staff responsibilities are primarily to manage the relationships of all of the outside managers. That includes monitoring their performance and ensuring that the managers are complying with the guidelines that we set up for the management of our funds, and also ensuring that we report on a quarterly basis to both the board and the an investment advisory council. We conduct searches for new investment managers on an ongoing basis. This requires us to perform due diligence of the managers. The process is that the staff will make recommendations to me. If they get by that, which is probably the toughest hurdle, we seek endorsement from the IC and ultimately approval by the board. We do manage some money internally. All of the state cash assets are managed internally. That's somewhere now in the order of $12 to $15 billion that we manage. It's all managed on a short-term basis, but is matched up. We get most of our instructions from MMB as to who's responsible, whose dollars we're responsible for, and the timing to which we can determine how long each of the asset accounts should be managed. So we work closely with the pension plans and other state agencies to determine what's the most appropriate vehicles to manage most of our assets. And, you know, in addition to the pension plans, the non-retirement assets, the state cash accounts, we do oversee the assets in the Minnesota deferred comp plan, the college savings plan, our healthcare savings plan, and the wide variety of state fire funds that we manage assets. I'd say that's probably the largest. The state fire plans are probably the largest bulk of clients that we have. So our administrative responsibilities, which are also shared quite a bit by the investment staff, given our side, it's to manage the relationships with our custodial bank and our external plan accounting activities. So that's to ensure that we have a good recording of the assets and that you know, we have safe custody with regards to the movement of the money. We take great pride in being over $100 billion in assets, and we take that responsibility. It's one that we do spend a lot of time focusing on, that we're being good stewards of the assets that we're responsible for. We've developed and implemented internal controls to ensure that everything goes correctly. We're responsible for the assets to provide the, in addition to paying the benefits, we put together our strategic asset allocation, which is a primary focus of management of the pension assets, to which we spend a fair amount of our time on. So, we prepare financial reports and schedules for the almost 400 investment plans that we're responsible for. Most of these are small, primarily the fire fighters and the state cash accounts. I think that's the last slide, Andy. So as you can see, that's in a nutshell kind of an overview of the operations of the staff. At the end of the fiscal year, we were responsible for $102 billion in assets. About $71 billion of those were the pension assets. As of this morning, that $71 billion over the last 6 months has grown to almost $84 billion. We've had a pretty strong and robust first 6 months of the fiscal year. While the economy is something that I've been very concerned about, we've been pretty fortunate that stock markets, our private equity program, and our fixed income programs have generated some pretty robust returns. So we feel that portfolio, which we made some tweaks to during the first quarter, is in pretty good shape to move forward. While we continue to have a pretty aggressive portfolio, about 75% of that is in equity markets, both public and private. We do have 25% of it's in fixed income, and we did restructure the portfolio to ensure that we have adequate liquidity over the next couple of years. That was the result of a lot of flashbacks to the great financial crisis, when liquidity was very difficult to get by with. So when things started to move that way last February and March, we made a concerted effort to make some revisions to our asset allocation to ensure that if the markets didn't rebound as quickly as they did, but if it had been prolonged, that we would be in pretty good shape to ensure that our participants would know that there was plenty of cash on hand to ensure that at least for the next couple of years that we had it safely guarded, and they wouldn't have to worry about receiving their monthly benefits. So we've been pretty fortunate in the performance that we provided for the pensions. I've been back for the last 7.5 years, and I've been pretty fortunate that I've been able to continue the type of performance that my predecessor and mentor, Howard Bicker, had provided for the state. And if you were to look at our performance versus our peers, which we consider to be the all public pension funds that with $50 billion or more, we rank as the 15th largest public plan in the United States, but feel pretty fortunate to say that we have consistently been a top quartile performer. And in the last 10 years, we've been a top decile performer. So we feel pretty good about what we've got going on, have a pretty knowledgeable staff. I had mentioned to Representative Nelson when we spoke last week that do get concerned that this type of performance won't last much longer into perpetuity unless we make some changes, which we're trying to do to make certain that we do have the depth on the staff that's needed to ensure that we're able to continue to do our job. The portfolio, I started with State Board of Investment back in 1990 when we had $17 billion. The portfolio has grown sixfold in that time period, and the staff has reduced by a person or two. So while we've been exceedingly productive, very concerned that we kind of keep up with, maybe not keep up with our peers. They all have significantly larger staffs than we do, but that we do need to make certain that we've got plenty of backup and are cultivating people to carry on when some of us move on. Any questions I can answer for anyone?
People, if you have questions, please raise your hands. I have a couple questions, and one is for clarification. You talked about the fire plans. That's the statewide plan that volunteer fire different departments have chosen to go into. You do not manage the individual statewide or fire relief associations that have not joined the statewide plan. Am I correct in that?
So there are two approaches. There's the statewide plan, which some organizations have joined, and we think that that's the preferred way. But other statewide plans are allowed to invest with us and either our equity, both domestic and international portfolios, and our fixed income portfolios. So they don't have to always join the statewide plan, which I personally believe should be something that they should be highly influenced to do, but they do have the ability to put some of their assets with us in some of our asset class portfolios.
And another question I have, and from time to time we get bills that come before the legislature to disinvest from Israel has been one I've seen in the past. They're trying to direct the pension or the investments, the State Board of Investment, to either disinvest or to invest in certain things. And what are your feelings on those type of bills?
Most people in my seat would say that to the extent that we reduce the investment opportunity set, that that gives us less flexibility. Since I've been back, there have been a lot of discussions about divestment and fossil fuel investments that we have in the portfolio. I've consistently pointed out that I'm a strong believer in what's happening with climate change, and believe that I share the concerns that many of the people who come to ask for divestment, but unfortunately, at times I have to point out to people that the legislature has said that I have a fiduciary responsibility to the participants in the plan. And so that makes it a little bit difficult to just kind of like willy-nilly say, well, I don't like this or that, we need to get rid of it. So it take a very, try to take a very objective approach to it. I believe at some point we will have significantly less fossil fuels in the program. I do not believe that today that I could make a recommendation that we just get rid of them. I have had some discussions with our board members about, you know, at some point we will be getting, we will be having less exposure. Last year, we did make recommendations the board approved that we no longer have investments in any company that received 25% or more of their their revenues are produced from thermal coal. So we've implemented that. We continue to pay attention as to what's going on, but one of the difficulties is that unfortunately, our economies are still very heavily dependent upon oil and gas to provide energy. And until there have been more advances to get better, clean energy available, there's going to continue to be a big demand for oil and gas. I tried to point out the discussion I had at the Pension Commission last year that, you know, unfortunately, transportation is one of the bigger problems we've got. If everyone today were to get rid of their internal combustion engine car and got an electric car, the grid would go down tomorrow. We don't have a big enough electric grid to handle that. To the extent that there are less reliance on it, we will be moving quicker to get out of fossil fuel based companies. But in the meantime, we take our responsibility as shareholders, you know, pretty significantly, and we've had we've engaged with a lot of organizations that and we vote our proxies to send messages to companies that they need to be moving to less fossil fuel reliant energy sources. You know, some of the companies that some of the organizations that we've aligned with, in order to do so, we have to point out that we are in agreement with the Paris Accords, which we are, although we've not made a overt statement to that regard. If you look at the engagement that we've had with some of the organizations we've got, it's very implicit in that we are. I believe that there will be less and less reliance on or less and less exposure to fossil fuels in our portfolio, but it will take time. People have noted that New York Common made a big splash earlier this month. And, you know, with regards to some of the proposals that we've had discussions about. And but when you read the paper, it comes out that New York Common has divested or said they're going to divest of fossil fuels. Nope, that's not what they've done. They said that they will be looking at it as we have. They've got more resources, so they'll probably get there quicker, but we'll be watching them closely for things that they do. But so I'd say that, you know, we haven't gone and stuck our heads in the sand. We realize that this is extremely important, but I don't have the luxury of just kind of like, well, people are upset. we ought to get rid of it. I can't make that recommendation. The legislature could do so, and then we'd follow it like we do with the restrictions, Sudan and Iran. But right now, my responsibility is to try to do whatever we can to ensure that we have appropriate assets to pay the benefits that the state owes to its employees.
Thank you. Members, any other questions? I don't see any hands raised. If not, give a couple more seconds here. If not, thank you, Mr. Manson, Mr. Perry, and thank you for your presentation. And with that, we'll move on to the Legislative Commission on Pensions and Retirement.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure always to talk to you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Ms. Lencheski.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Nelson. We have a PowerPoint that Chad Burkett, who is with me from the commission, will be working through with us. Thank you for this opportunity to talk to the commission.
If you want to introduce yourself for the record, please.
Yes, I'm sorry. My name is Susan Lencheski, and I'm the Executive Director of the Legislative Commission on Pensions and Retirement. Chad Burkett is with me today. He is our analyst. The final staff person that works for the commission is Lisa Dieselin, who I'm sure is behind the scenes watching this. She's a valued member of our staff and has been with the legislature for, I think, close to 20 years. Chair Nelson, I just want to note that you are a longtime member of the commission, and we've very much appreciated your experience and expertise with pension matters. I think we're having a little technical trouble.
Are you able to see the presentation?
I am not.
All I'm seeing is a narrow slide.
Slice of it.
Yeah, a narrow slice of it.
I'm not sure what to do about that.
Right, on sharing and sharing again.
While we're waiting, Representative Kosnick, you've got your hand up. You have a question now, or do you want to wait till the presentation's over?
I was waiting for after the presentation, but.
Okay. We got it. It looks like we got the presentation up now. I'll call on you first after the presentation, if that's okay.
That'd be great. Thank you, Chair.
Go ahead, Ms. Lencheski.
All right, thank you, Chair Nelson. We're on into slide five, it looks like, which that's just fine. The LCPR, as we call it, or the commission, is a joint commission, which means that it has members from both the Senate and the House. We have seven representatives and seven senators, so a total of 14 members. We have our senators appointed for this session, but we are awaiting direction from the leadership of both caucuses to provide us with the House members. We have an executive committee that is appointed by or elected by the membership of the commission, and that's the chair. We believe this year the chair will be a senator because last biennium we had a member of the House as our chair. It alternates every biennium between the two chambers. The vice chair will be a representative from the House. It usually goes, the vice chair is from the other chamber, and then the secretary as well. So that's our executive committee. The reason for it being a joint commission, I'm not entirely clear about how that all came to be, but I think it has to do with the fact that pensions are generally not all that partisan. There's a sort of a long-term commitment that the state has to employees across the state, public employees, and I think there's some value in having a bipartisan approach to this. So I believe that's part of the reason. The other reason I believe is that pensions are very complicated. So experience in the private sector or in the public sector with pensions is very valuable, and certainly experience on the commission, sort of biennium after biennium, is very helpful to understanding the complexity of this system. As I mentioned, we have three staff people. We work with the commission to prepare for meetings. We tend to generally have weekly meetings during the session, and then during the interim, occasionally we have meetings. The commission does have its own actuary. Van Eiwarden Associates is a local firm officed in Minneapolis. They were retained, as I note here, in December of 2019 after an RFP process, and they will be our actuary for the next 3 years. We have a website, lcpr.leg.mn. Chad, you want to move to the next page? Yeah, so we've got a screenshot here of the website. If you should have any questions on the commission or on pending legislation or on the pension plans that the commission has oversight, this is a great place to go. If you can see across the top there, the red band, the dropdown for meetings will provide you with the agendas for upcoming meetings, as well as for past meetings and the materials from those meetings. Pension legislation will be all the pension-related bills that have been introduced. We tend to gather them all and list them here. Those are subject to the chair of the commission as to whether they will be heard by the commission, but we collect all the pending legislation here so that if anybody wants to look at what has currently been introduced, that's the place to go. The dropdown for the actuarial and financial reporting is also valuable in that the plans send us their actuarial reports. So all of the pension funds that the commission has oversight will send us their reports. We post them here. They are very, I think, interesting to look at. They provide lots of information about the funding status, the number of members in the plan, number of retirees, lots of information in those reports. As I mentioned, the chair will make the decision as to what bills will be heard, but they are always pension-related bills, and they tend to focus on changes in the statutes that govern the pension fund. So there are four chapters, I think, that are most relevant to the fund, starting with Chapter 352. So changes to those are set forth in the bills that the commission hears. As you can see, some of the more sensitive ones that that are taken up by the commission have to do with change in the rates of the employer and employee contributions. Those are obviously important to employees if they need to contribute more to the fund. Also to employers who may have to contribute more in order to keep the fund sustainable. Another item I'll just note is the ongoing and ever-present volunteer firefighter relief associations that we spend a lot of time on every session. That system has, I suppose because there's so many of these across the state, they tend to have a lot of issues that come up and a lot of tweaking of the statutes that continue to be necessary. Finally, the commission approves the actuarial assumptions that the plans use to calculate their liabilities. The most important of those is the discount rate or rate of return assumption. Right now that's set at 7.5% for all the plans and is kind of what we're hoping that Mr. Perry will meet every year in order for us to continue to keep the plans well funded. Moving on to slide 6. This is the committee to which pension bills are initially referred, and then sort of due to past practice, this committee then passes them over to the pension commission, which then hears the bills. The commission will take testimony, review the bills, may make amendments to the bills. If the bill is approved, it will go back to, it'll tend to generally be put into an omnibus bill, so we'll have one big bill by the end of the session. And that will then go back to this committee for review and approval, hopefully, and then on to the chamber for adoption. Moving on to slide 7. As I mentioned, there's a number of plans, pension plans, that are reviewed and taken up by the commission every session. The Minnesota State Retirement System administers 5 pension plans, 2 defined contribution plans, PARA, 4 pension plans, and 1 defined contribution plan. Teachers Retirement Association is 1 pension plan for our teachers. And then there is also on the next screen, I'll move there in a moment, but the St. Paul Teachers Retirement Fund is the only local plan, and that is just for the teachers of St. Paul. I will note that both MSRS and PARA have public safety plans. So under MSRS, there's the state patrol plan as well as the correctional plan. PARA has its own correctional plan for the county jails, those employees. And then they also have the police and fire plan, which we hear quite a bit about. It has all the police and, throughout the state and the firefighters who are career firefighters. As I mentioned on slide, moving on to slide 8, we have the St. Paul Teachers Retirement Fund. And then also, as you can see here, the Volunteer Firefighters Relief Associations. Right now, I guess the last count is 563 of those. They provide retirement benefits, relatively small benefits, to our volunteer firefighters throughout the state. Moving on to slide 9. Our pension plans are administered by the state statutes. Or that are governed by the state statutes. So starting with chapter 352 and on to 353 and 354, those are the plan documents. So every time there's a need to change a benefit, we go in and amend the statute. Just a couple of facts here about the pension funds. They require both employee and employer contributions, which makes them quite a bit different than pension plans in the private sector, where those tend to be only funded by employer contributions. Most pensions are paid out as lifetime annuities, and they always have spousal and sometimes dependent benefits that are also paid. Pension eligibility, benefits, vesting, contribution rates, all are provided in the statute. So if you should ever wanna take a look at what, say, the vesting requirements are for the police and fire plan, it is listed, or it is provided in the statutes. Each of the funds has its own governing board and executive director. So MSRS, PARA, TRA, those are what we mean by the fund. These board members and the executive directors are fiduciaries. Mr. Perry mentioned that he too is a fiduciary, as is the State Board of Investment and the Investment Advisory Council. That means they have a much higher standard of conduct and standard of duty. To make sure that they are acting solely in the interest of the members and retirees. And they are too governed by statute. So fiduciaries have to comply with fiduciary duty as set forth in our chapter 356A. Finally, pension assets, as I mentioned, they are kept separate, and we heard from Mr. Perry that they are separate, the 70 or so billion. Now I think he said 84 billion. They can't be commingled with other funds, and they are held for the exclusive benefit of plan members. I won't spend any time on this slide. We just heard from Mr. Perry. He went through everything that is on that slide, so I'll just move on. Slides 11 and 12 talk about what was addressed during the last biennium. So during the 2019 session, we had an omnibus bill, as we do every year. That bill included a number of items that are sort of common themes that are in our bills. The last one here is the administrative changes to the statutes. We have many of those every session, and those are taken up by the commission, often generally approved and then put into the omnibus bill. Another one that I mentioned here that is a common theme is the Volunteer Firefighter Relief Association. So every session we amend those statutes. This one here was to change, this is the second bullet, was to change the required number of years until you reach full vesting from 20 years to 10 years, which I think was appreciated by the firefighters, so that now in order to get a full pension, they only have to work 10 years rather than 20 years. Moving on to slide 12. Last session, so the 2020 session, we had similar topics. We, as you can see here, the last one, administrative changes, a number of those. The third bullet here talks again about the Volunteer Firefighter Relief Associations. We had a number of changes, in fact, fairly significant changes last session to the laws governing our relief associations. We increased the maximum lump sum amount that the reliefs can pay out as a benefit from $10,000 per year of service to $15,000 per year of service. So some of the suburban metro plans have very rich benefits relative to the others across the state. So they can go up to as high as $15,000 per year of service, and that is the retirement benefit payable at the end of their volunteer service. We also put into place some procedures for converting from a defined benefit plan to a defined contribution plan. And we also did some significant revision to the laws on dissolution of relief associations. One other item I'll mention here is the first bullet. This was the result of a task force or a little work group that met during the interim. We worked with about 25 representatives from the City of St. Paul, the school district, and the building and construction trades, and arrived at some resolution to some issues that had come up relating to contributions that were being made to multi-employer plans, in addition to the para pensions. So that is all I'll say, I guess, about what we worked on in 2020 and 2019. Before I turn this over to Chad, I will note at the end of our presentation is a slide on how you can reach us. The three of us are all working remotely during the pandemic. We will respond immediately to emails, and we also are happy to share our cell phone numbers. So if that would be something that you like, where you want to just get on the phone with one of us and talk through a question, send an email. We'll provide our cell phone number and happy to talk with you really anytime. I'll pass it over to Chad to discuss the topic of COLAs.
And Mr. Burkett, if you want to state your name for the tape and then proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Again, Chad Burkett, I'm the analyst for the Legislative Commission on Pensions and Retirement. The rest of this presentation deals with the COLA report we were asked to provide some information on. Back in 2018, we passed a major reform bill intended to improve funding for a number of our statewide plans. And one of the ways in which it improved funding was to reduce COLA benefits for a number of plans and to change them for others. And in Minnesota law, we call these COLA benefits post-retirement adjustments. So if you see that language used, but they're more generally referred to as cost of living adjustments. You might be familiar with how Social Security does it. Here in Minnesota, we've been using a fixed annual increase of like 1% or 2% each year. The way in which the 2018 bill changed these benefits, here's a summary on this slide. And I'll just point out that for the most part, it just reduced fixed rates from 2% down to 1 or 1.5%. But for the para general plan and para correctional plans, it actually came up with a new approach, maybe a philosophical change in the approach for COLAs. Just looking at the para general plan, for example, instead of a flat increase, it changed the increase so that it was tied to inflation through Social Security. So for the para general plan, it's half of inflation, but with a floor and a cap
So if inflation were 2.5% next year, then the increase would be 1.25% or half of that, but it would never be more than 1.5% or less than 1%. So because of these changes and the inconsistency in the way that in the way that the state is administering these quotas now, we're asked to put together a study, and the study was supposed to take into account a few things. So first is the purpose of the state's COLA. The second is alternative methods for providing COLAs. And the third was to evaluate the new method that PARA was using. And we did produce that report and are planning to present it to the LCPR this session. And we'll see if the LCPR decides to adopt it or not. And basically what it is a 58-page report, a fairly lengthy, maybe definitive work on COLAs in Minnesota. And it really covers everything there is to know about COLAs in Minnesota, just including the background information, summary of what other states are doing and how that can relate to Minnesota's COLA benefits, and discussion on the purpose, and especially some analysis on whether our current COLA structure is offsetting inflation for our retirees, and whether we expect it to continue doing that in the future. I won't say much about the process that we went through, but I will just note that we did produce a first draft of the report, which was shared with the public back in November, and we received a number of public comments on the report. Those public comments have been appended to the report. They're on the end, not included in the 58-page count, so even longer. But I think they provide some good insight into what our various public employee groups and government watch groups that pay attention to pension issues think about COLAs here. And I'll just note, this is the last thing I'll say about the COLA report, is we did, this isn't the sort of a report where we came up with recommendations for policy changes. Ms. Lincheski and I are nonpartisan staff, so we'd be very careful about doing that in any case. But we did come to a few conclusions, and I'll just go over the ones that we think are most important. And so the first two here deal with whether or not the COLAs that we have actually mitigate, or to the degree they mitigate, the loss of purchasing power. And for all of the plans, that the statewide plans other than the PARA correctional plan, we do expect them to offset inflation in the future, but not to fully offset inflation. And plan members should expect to see some erosion of their purchasing power over time. And in the report, we detail how much they should expect that. I mentioned that the PARA correctional plan is different. Basically, they have a higher rate. And as a result, we think that they should substantially or completely offset future inflation. And then the other thing that we noted is that members of the PARA police and fire plan and the MSR state patrol plan are likely the most vulnerable to a loss of purchasing power. And that's because they don't receive Social Security benefits as part of their pension compensation. And also we expect them to receive a benefit for longer. So there's a longer period during which their benefit can erode. And then we also looked at the PARA method and did some evaluation of whether, what effect that has on the protection from inflation. And the change in method really had very little impact on how much protection they received from inflation. But we did see some marginal or moderate improvement in intergenerational equity, which, if you're extremely nerdy, you think is very interesting. We looked at the alternative methods for providing COLAs, and there wasn't a clearly superior alternative method for providing COLAs to Minnesota. Again, as nonpartisan staff, we look at this and say, well, okay, given all of the things that go into setting the COLAs, they're one that's clearly superior, there isn't. But we did lay out a number of alternatives, and I guess our hope would be that
as policymakers like yourselves are considering changes to COLAs in the future, that this would be a good resource for maybe a menu of options to consider. So that's all I have, Mr. Chair, on the COLA report. I'm happy to take any questions. I'm sure Ms. Lachesi is as well.
Okay, members. Yeah, I'm unmuted. Okay, members. I might have a couple of questions, and then I'll get to Representative Kozniak's questions. Things that we hear and we may hear, one is MRF. What is MRF and where are they now being taken care of? MRF is the Minneapolis Retirement Fund, Minneapolis Employee Retirement Fund. We hear about MRF a lot, or we have in the past, and I guess where are they right now in the orbit of what's going on and where we're at? Ms. Lincheski.
Thank you, Chair Nelson. MRF is a kind of perennial topic for the Pension Commission and the legislature. It relates back to several years ago when the Minneapolis Employees Retirement Fund was merged into PERA. Currently, under current law, the Minneapolis employers contribute $21 million a year to PERA, while the state contributes $16 million to PERA. And the Minneapolis employers involved here is the city, the school district, Hennepin County, Met Council, Metropolitan Airports Commission, and Minneapolis Parks and Rec Board. So those are the employers. They all share this burden. They contribute currently $21 million, and the state contributes $16 million. What happens every couple of years or so, though, is that these numbers change a little bit. So they ratchet up and down. So a couple of years ago, the annual contribution for the Minneapolis employers was $31 million, so $10 million more than it is today. And the state's contribution then was $6 million, so it went from $16 to $6 million. This just sort of depends on the legislature makes this call. This is a policy decision as to how much the state is going to share with Minneapolis. Relating back to this merger, and the reason there is this sort of unfunded liability is that MRF, when it was merged into PERA, was very, very much underfunded. PERA took on this liability, and now the state and the employers are paying back this liability.
Thank you. And then another question I have has to do with, you mentioned that with the police and fire, but what is a coordinated plan and what is a basic plan? You kind of touched on that with the police, but if you could explain that for some members that may not understand that.
Yeah. Thank you, Chair Nelson. And Chad can speak on this as well. But basically, it means that the member has not been paying into Social Security. And so these are the basic members. If we call them a basic member, that means that they have not been paying into Social Security during their career with the state or the city or county, and thus when they retire, they will not be eligible for any Social Security benefits. We refer to a member as a coordinated member because their pension, their retirement income is coordinated with Social Security. So that means that they will receive a pension from the state as well as Social Security, and they will then have paid into the system, the Social Security system, during their employment. We only have two plans that are so-called basic plans, and those are the two public safety plans. One is the state patrol plan, and the other is the para police and fire plan. And the members of those plans have not been paying into Social Security and therefore will not receive a Social Security benefit based on that period of employment. They may also receive Social Security based on other employment they've had. So for instance, if they worked after retirement as a security guard for a private company, they then will be able to pay into the system and get a Social Security benefit. But for their period of employment with the public employer, they have not paid into Social Security and so are considered basic members.
And Ms. Lincheski, I know the answer, but why is it that they're not paying into Social Security and they just have the pension going back historically? Ms. Lincheski.
Thank you. And again, I'll invite Chad if he has a better recollection. So many years ago, there continues to be, and there was then, an ability for a workforce to opt out of Social Security. It's a chapter 187 agreement or something like that under federal law. Years ago then, there was, I think, a vote taken actually of the members at the time, and they voted to not contribute to Social Security and be apart from that system. So it's been that way for many, many years. I would also note that both of the teachers' plans have a few basic members as well. And so those folks have, you know, years ago, they were not in as part of the Social Security system. After a certain date, everybody became a coordinated member in those two plans. And so we no longer have many of these basic members. They're solely retiring and leaving the system.
And part of it was that members, it was that some of these plans, like the state patrol plan and some of the police and fire plans, were started and were up and running long before Social Security ever came into effect. So that's why they remain, that's why they're that way they are. A lot of the MRF, the people that were in MRF, the Minneapolis, again, they were, those plans were started before Social Security. So that's why that's, they never joined Social Security, never paid into that. And I guess the other last question I have, you mentioned about the discount rate or the assumed rate of return. Why is that important when we talk about what that rate is? How does that affect the plan? If we raise the assumed rate of return or lower the assumed rate of return, how does that affect the investment and the security of the plan? Ms. Lincheski.
Yeah, thank you, Chair Nelson. So as I mentioned, the assumed rate of return right now is 7.5. As that rate goes down, so what it's based on is what we believe, based on what the actuaries tell us, what we believe current assets will be able to earn over sort of the amortization period within the plan. So we're looking at what we think Mr. Perry is going to be able to achieve in investment returns over a very long period of time, typically as long as 30 years. So if that rate of return goes down, it's used in calculating liability. So these are what the plan owes to members in the form of benefits. So if we assume less, smaller returns, those liabilities go up. So that means we're going to have to contribute more to make up for that assumed loss of earnings over this long period of time. So if we were to ratchet it down to 7%, we would suddenly see this spike in the what the actuaries determine as the benefit liabilities for the funds. A few years ago, the rate of return was higher than 7.5. And so there was quite a bit of discussion at the legislature and in the commission on lowering that rate. And that did cause a corresponding increase in the benefit liabilities as determined by the actuaries. Chad, do you have anything you'd like to add to that?
No, I think, thank you, Mr. Chair. I think you covered that well. I'll leave it at that.
Representative Kosniak, you had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And the question is, I appreciate the report, the COLA report, and we'd worked in the past. And I'm wondering, was there a plan to study the adequacy of police benefits? We previously had a bill introduced, Ms. Lucheski, we talked about it in my office a little bit. Is that something I need to reintroduce, or there was talk that the commission was going to do it on its own, but over the number of years, I don't believe that they have. So could you update me on that if you recall the discussion?
Ms. Lincheski.
Thank you, Chair Nelson and Representative Kosniak. I think that we should maybe talk offline. It is true that changes were not made, and I'm trying to recall exactly what we had looked at for the bill that we talked about. And I'm sorry to say I can't remember the details. I don't know if you can recall what it was.
Yeah, no, Mr. Chair.
Representative Kosniak.
Yeah, thank you. What it was looking at was for younger officers that happen to be totally or permanently disabled in the line of duty, but they have been on their police force for a very long time, had significantly different benefits than if they had been on the force maybe 10 years or even longer. And the situation is that we asked these officers to put their life on the line for us. A real recent example is the officer in Owatonna Right now, he will get some decent benefits for the first couple of years, but those benefits will change because he hasn't been in the plan for very long. And so he being permanently and totally disabled isn't able to earn an income in a different profession or anything, but he is not able to receive the same benefits that a different officer would if they had been on the force. And I'm just going to guess because I don't know the exact, so don't quote it. But, you know, like if he'd been working as a police officer for 10 or 15 years, he will receive significantly different benefits. And so there was a big discussion about it from a constituent of mine that was an injured Minneapolis officer. There was a lot of discussion over the years with my predecessor, former Representative Holberg, that the commission should at least take a look at the differences and if we are providing adequate benefits for younger officers that are permanently and totally disabled and not able to earn a different income somewhere else after their injury.
Ms. Flancheski.
Thank you, Chair Nelson and Representative Koznick. Yes, I do recall that we had discussed that and that we may have even put a bill together. I'll ask Chad, also Mr. Burkett, to speak to this, but I think the issue that we had been looking at the time was there's an offset for workers' comp, a compensation that is paid to these disabled folks, and it's quite a reduction in the benefit that they would have otherwise received. And it does have some kind of really anomalous effects on certain individuals, like these young officers that get disabled. Sort of a larger look at the system, so this would include workers' comp as well as disability benefits under PARA, is probably long overdue. And would be something I think that the commission could take up if, you know, the chair would like to go ahead and do that. So I think you're right. I think, I know you're right about there having been this issue, and I think a further look at this would be great. Chair Nelson, if I might turn it over to Chad quickly to talk just a little bit about what PARA is looking at by way of some changes to their disability benefit. Does not address this workers' comp offset, but it does have some impact on the disability benefits that would be paid out of PARA.
And Madam, Ms. Flancheski and Chad, that has to do with the people that retire or get disability close to the normal retirement age. Is that what we're talking about, Mr. Burkett?
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Yes, the PARA legislation does deal specifically with taxability of disability benefits for people who are over the normal retirement age of 55. I think one point that Representative Koznick brought up was that how COLAs play with the disability benefits for police officers. Because they have a cost of living adjustment of 1% annually, someone who's injured in the line of duty at a young age we'll see their increase go up at 1%, which is roughly half or a little bit less even than what we assume for inflation. So by the time that person's reaching age 55 or a normal retirement age, they've actually seen a significant erosion of their benefit. And then, of course, if they live well into a normal retirement period into their 70s or 80s, that could erode additionally. So I think that's where some of the concern came up, at least in a particular case with disability benefits. And then as Ms. Flancheski noted, they are coordinated with the disability benefits for police officers are coordinated with their workers' compensation benefits and there's an offset there. So I think both of those things need to be explored together.
Representative Koznick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And it's Koznick, but that's
Koznick. Okay. Yeah, I'm sorry. I look at it and I mess that up every time. I apologize.
That's no problem. I'll continue to work offline and then reintroduce the bill and hope to have some support. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Mason.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think it was around slide 12. There was, it said there's a service credit for military service. Can someone explain that to me a little bit more in detail?
Ms. Flancheski or Mr. Burkett?
Yeah, Chair Nelson and Representative Mawson. So this was back, I'm not sure if it was 2020 or 2019, but we did include that in the list of items that had been addressed. And this relates to individuals who either have some military service generally in the reserves prior to coming to public employment, or take a time out during public employment and go, you know, serve some time in the military, in the reserves. Those individuals have always had the right under federal law called USERRA, which is, I think, the I'm not even sure what exactly it is, but USERRA, U-S-E-R-R-A, federal act that allows them to return to service, to public employment, and then allows them to retain rights that they would have had under their pension plan. So this applies to both public and private employers. So we've always had this federal right, which is in our statutes, that allows people to come back from military service and then buy back service for the period of time that they were away from public employment. We kind of expanded that right in this most recent round of changes that was enacted, I think, in 2019, but I'm forgetting which year. And that expanded that right so that in addition to the right that you have to do this under the federal law, you also have a right now to do it under state law. And the reason the state law is good to have as well is that the federal law has some due dates. So it has some cutoffs. Like if you don't respond to your public employer and ask to buy back service by a particular date, you lose that right. So we expanded that to allow for a longer period of time to buy back this military service. So the way it works is the PARA in this case will calculate how much you owe, which is missed employee contributions. And then you pay that in and you get your service back. That's under federal law. Under state law, it's a little bit more expensive in that they determine the actuarial value of the additional service and require you to pay that amount. And then you get back that service. And that'll, you know, make sure that your benefit stays intact and is not reduced for the period of military service.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Mason.
Thank you.
Any further questions? I just want to look back on that slide 12. Members, you may hear some about augmentation, and there are some people that used to be, and some of it has to be hospitals, but they used to be public state employees or local employees, and then those places were privatized, and they ended making payments into the state pension plans. And there used to be augmentation. And Ms. Lincheski, if you want to talk about that and explain that, I've gotten a few emails about that where people have feel that their pension was cut because of the lack of augmentation. Ms. Lincheski.
Yes, thank you, Chair Nelson. This is a topic that just doesn't seem to really go away. And so what it relates to, and it's a really kind of a niche thing. So if someone works for the state for a number of years or for the city or county, but then they terminate service. So they leave public service, but they're not old enough to start getting their pension. So they're not yet 55 or some retirement age after that. Those members are considered deferred vested members. So they have a benefit, but they're not entitled to get it. So for the period of time between their termination of service, public service, and the date they receive the pension, our law used to provide them with a guaranteed annual increase in that pension benefit. So it used to be like 2%. It was even much higher than that for certain groups. Some of these groups that received these enhanced augmentation benefits included a group you may remember from a few years ago. We called them the Fairview employees. They were employees that were employed by the University of Minnesota Hospitals, which then spun off the Fairview system. Those employees were getting anywhere from 5 to 7% guaranteed annual increase in their pension benefit, as I mentioned, every year from the date of the spinoff to the date they started to collect their pension. And this had some really odd results in that people could have, you know, as much as twice or even three times the benefit that they would have accrued to the date that they left service because of this deferred augmentation. And it was, and we called it enhanced augmentation in the case of these privatizations. So this, a couple years ago in 2018, we took away augmentation altogether for all employees, and that was at about 2% rate, except for PARA, it was at less than that. I think PARA actually had no augmentation at that time. And the reason for doing this is that we pay COLAs, we pay these annual increases on retiree benefits, but augmentation is really unique to Minnesota. None of the other state pension systems around the country provide this kind of a benefit, and it costs you know the plans money. And so as we were trying to work through benefits that would that probably should be on the chopping block, I guess we'll say, in order to keep the systems funded at a reasonable funding ratio, that augmentation was eliminated generally in 2018, and now we're looking at getting rid of some more enhanced augmentation in some other cases where hospitals are privatizing, leaving PARA, and then getting these enhanced augmentation benefits.
So, thank you. Any further questions from members? I'll wait a couple seconds here if people raise their hands. Any further questions for members? If not, thank you, Ms. Lincheski, Mr. Burkitt, for the presentation. Hopefully we won't have any real contentious bills that we have to take up in the pension plan. And members, when the pension bill comes forward, there's also from time to time, and I think there's one that was put in already, that are what they call one-offs, that where somebody was, for some reason, some of their service time wasn't credited, they weren't paid in on, and they're trying to fix mistakes that happen from time to time. There are usually one or two of those in the bills. We used to get a lot of, before we changed the law back about 10 years ago to mirror the federal ERISA Act about the pensions are 50% of their spouse, it's assumed 50% for life for the spouse. It used to be 100% of the pension went to the member, unless the wife signed off, had to opt into giving that benefit to their wife. And we would get the pension commission every year, one or two 90-year-old, usually it was women, whose husband had passed away, and now the pension stopped and they had nothing. And that's something we fixed a few years back, but sometimes we'll get these goofy one-off ones where a mistake was made and they're trying to fix those. So you'll see those in the pension bill when it comes through. Again, Ms. Lincheski, Mr. Burkitt, thank you for your time. Members, that's all what we have for today. If we have no more questions, our next meeting is next Tuesday morning. We're gonna have Minnesota Management and Budget in front of us and the Board of Cosmetology Examiners in front of us. And also one of the things we're gonna be asking them, and I hope Minnesota IT is here for them, is they've had a big IT project, Minnesota Board of Cosmetology did, and we should be asking questions and finding out how that has gone and where they're at with that, and go from there. So members, with that, if there's not any more questions or anything I forgot, Ms. Rudolph or Ms. Spreck, I see shaking their head, then we're adjourned. Thank you, members.